Hello and welcome to this week's episode of Memcast. This week we are going to be talking a little bit about how we classify hemolytic anemias. We're very lucky this week we're joined by a hematology registrar from South Yorkshire, Dr. Aritri Mandal, and she's going to take us through the varying kinds of hemolytic anemias, how we categorise them and the different ways in which they cause disease. Also, quick mention, if you haven't seen them this week, please pop onto the Instagram and check out the MRCP questions for this week and make sure you've had a look at those before listening. So thank you very much for joining us, Aritri.
Hello.
Hi, it's very, very good to have you on. So you can take us through all the incredibly complicated hematology that I can no longer remember.
I'm sure that's not true, but happily.
Perfect. So would you be able to, for those of us who do have memory, roughly the lifespan of a red cell, talk us through a little bit about the red cell physiology?
Oh, I love that joke. I wonder how long you've been keeping that one on up your sleeve.
All week I've been waiting to say it.
So red cells they're obviously made in the bone marrow. There's a common hematopoietic stem cell progenitor, and it will eventually, the multiple cellular stages of division, will eventually become a red blood cell, reticulocyte first, then a red blood cell. The reticulocytes are important for later down the line. Then they tend to live in the bloodstream for around 120 days, and then they tend to be eliminated by either the liver or the spleen.
Perfect. Right. Well, actually, I think the cell lasts a little longer than my memory then. So obviously the aim of the podcast today is to take us through the varying ways in which the red cells can become hemolyzed. And there's huge numbers of different ways of categorizing the different kinds of hemolytic anemias. What kind of way do you tend to split them up when you're thinking about them?
Yeah, I find it's a very complicated, big topic. I think that to try and keep it simple, I try to think of it as an immune-mediated problem or a non-immune-mediated problem. So has the immune system been at fault or has it not, basically? So I guess with immune-mediated problems, the main ones to look out for are autoimmune hemolysis, so where the body has produced an antibody against itself, or an alloimmune-mediated hemolysis, where you develop an antibody because of sensitization to something else, and that causes you to make an antibody, which then causes your red blood cells to break down. And then for the non-immune-mediated, I like to sort of work from the inside of the red cell to the outside. So if you think about what's on the inside of the red blood cell, you've got hemoglobin. Hemoglobin, when that goes wrong, you have conditions like sickle cell disease, thalassemia, which we'll go into in a bit more detail shortly. You also have enzymes that live in the cell, so things like G6PD, PK, and then on the outside of the red blood cells, there are many proteins that can have mutations, and they can cause the actual cellular shape to change. So you would have something like spherocytosis or hereditary elliptocytosis, for example. And then they're the predominantly the red cell ones, but there are also non-immunological causes of hemolysis that aren't anything to do with red cells. And that would be more in keeping with things like, for example, mechanical, so heart valves, microangiopathic hemolytic anemia, paroxysmal nocturnal hemoglobinuria, various drugs also can contribute.
So we've got plenty of different things to be thinking about and considering if we ever suspect that someone has a hemolytic anemia. Shall we start with the autoimmune? We start with those ones and go a little bit through, because I remember being told there's warm and cold. What kind of things are we thinking about with those?
Yeah, so we can start with autoimmune. There are two different types, broadly speaking, warm and cold. And for the actual causes of either warm or cold, there are multiple also, in terms of it could be primary, so completely idiopathic, or it could be secondary. And it's usually as a result of things like lymphoma, infection, other malignancies, drugs mainly. And autoimmune basically just means that your body has produced an antibody to itself. So it is causing its own breakdown of its own red cells. And if it's warm autoimmune hemolysis, it tends to be because of a IgG type of antibody, which causes breakdown of that red blood cell via monocytes or macrophages in the spleen. And these antibodies react best, unfortunately, at 37 degrees or optimum body temperature, basically. Then you've got cold hemolysis, and there's various different types of cold hemolysis also, but just to keep it simple, tends to be as a result of an IgM type antibody, and this fixes complement to the red blood cell and it causes complement mediated destruction of the red cell. And these react best at 4 to 20 degrees, so it tends to be a bit of a lab in vitro kind of phenomenon. So it doesn't tend to be that important for the body, but it's important to check what sort of thermal range that antibody works in and to know how clinically significant it is. But just a couple that tend to come up for MRCP, there's cold hemagglutinin disease, and that tends to be associated with mycoplasma infections. That's a good one for the MCQs. And the blood film would tends to show sort of agglutination. If you warm that blood film, or if you warm the blood itself, then you'd be able to see it and it would look more normal. If you transfuse patient, just ensure that you remember to give warmed blood, otherwise the coldness of the blood product can also cause hemolysis also, or exacerbate hemolysis. There's also a mixed type where there's warm and cold, and there's various treatments for this, which include sort of steroids and rituximab, which is a monoclonal antibody to B cells, which make the antibodies.
I had a quick question. If the cold autoimmune disease reacts at sort of 4 to 20, bar those situations that you mentioned where you're like maybe putting colder products into somebody's bloodstream, are you ever going to have hemolysis in vivo in those cases?
Yes. So sometimes these antibodies are also reactive. They can have a large temperature range of activity, I should say. So they can actually sometimes react at body temperature, which would then cause problems. Sometimes also the question stem might actually say something along the lines of someone was playing out in the snow, came back in, felt very unwell, jaundiced, etc. Then you can also think of it like that.
Perfect. Well, that makes perfect sense now. In terms of we've talked about warm and cold. Were there any other on the autoimmune spectrum that you wanted to mention before we went on to the other causes?
I'll just touch briefly upon alloimmune. It tends to be as a result of giving multiple transfusions. So the problem with transfusions is that it's obviously a allogeneic blood product. So it's bought from someone else and given to a patient. And there might be small alterations in the proteins on the red cell surface, which then might get recognized by the patient's body as being not self, and then they will produce an antibody. And then next time they get, if they get that particular antigen on their red blood cells transfused to them, that can cause breakdown of the red cells. So it's just important to be aware that anyone who's having lots and lots of transfusions, that they are at higher risk of developing alloimmune hemolysis.
So if we've got autoimmune, we've got alloimmune, you were then talking about defects in the cell itself that can cause it to lyse, and you sort of had an approach of working your way from the inside out. What kind of things are we looking at there?
Yeah, so obviously we touched upon all of them, but starting from the inside of the cell, we've got hemoglobin, which is the oxygen carrying component. If there is a mutation in the hemoglobin gene, that can cause sickle cell disease. It tends to be on the beta globin gene that causes the most problems. And it basically, under various circumstances, it can cause the cells to sickle, deform, and the usual kind of presentation of sickle cell disease, causing sort of vaso-occlusive painful crisis or sequestration crisis, etc. Then you've also got the actual hemoglobin genes might be completely deleted. So that produces thalassemia. So you can sort of think of it as a qualitative or a quantitative kind of defect. So if there's a single point mutation, it tends to form sickle cell disease. Whereas if a whole gene is deleted and not present, then it causes thalassemia. And these patients are heavily transfused, so again, have other reasons for having hemolytic anemia. But also there's just a constant sort of breakdown of their red cells. There's constant hemolysis in their conditions. And it's really important that if you have patients who have these conditions, you just pick up the phone and discuss with us about it, because we'd want to know and we can help guide their treatment. And then we've got enzyme problems. So the main one, I think, for MRCP tends to be the G6PD deficiency. And I don't know how much people want to talk about this, but it goes back to the old Krebs cycle where...
I've just had a bit of PTSD when you said Krebs cycle.
I'm sorry. So G6PD is glucose 6 phosphate dehydrogenase. It's basically an enzyme. It usually, when it's present, it would help reduce NADP to NADPH. And then NADPH is what's needed by the red cell to reduce another substance called glutathione. And glutathione is necessary because it helps to mop up and remove free oxidants and then therefore stop free oxidant oxidative hemolysis, essentially. So these patients tend to present with mainly jaundice, anemia, and their blood film might show things like bite, blister, Heinz bodies. They're all buzzwords that are important. And they will all have triggers. And the main things to watch out for are things like drugs and food. So sometimes drugs such as antibiotics like quinolones, so Cipro, nitrofurantoin also, and then other things like antimalarials, septrin, raspberricase, they can all precipitate anemia in these people. The main food substance tends to be fava beans. It's always the one that I remember. I've never really come across fava beans in day-to-day life, but that's what can happen. And then things like infection, illnesses like DKA, they can also precipitate hemolytic anemia in this patient cohort. So that's the enzyme one. And then around the cell surface of the red blood cell, there's these proteins, ankyrin, spectrin, and BAN3. You probably don't need to know that in that much detail, but if there's a defect in these, which tend to all be autosomal dominant defects, then you could end up with hereditary spherocytosis and hereditary elliptocytosis. And hereditary spherocytosis is the most commonly inherited hemolytic anemia in Northern Europeans, so might see it quite a bit more commonly than anything else. And you basically have fragile sphere-shaped red cells that are really easily broken down when they pass through the spleen. The main thing to take away from this is just to take a really good history, make sure that you've taken a good family history, and get the hematologist to have a look at a blood film, which will show some spherocytes. More specialist testing would be something called an EMA binding test. And then the hereditary elliptocytosis is similar, just with them you would see elliptocytes on the film. It's also autosomal dominant. And you treat them both kind of similarly. So you would mainly just give them folic acid. And a lot of them you can end up watching and waiting, especially in adulthood. It's managed a little differently in pediatrics. And you can consider things like splenectomy. And you can also ensure that you've done an ultrasound abdomen to look for gallstones and consider whether they would also need a cholecystectomy as a result.
So we've gone through, like you said, we've started in the middle and worked our way out. I'm deeply upset that you've managed to make Krebs cycle relevant. I'm going to have to deal with the fact that there was a reason for me learning it now.
I'm sorry.
So, I forgive you. You mentioned as well that there were other things that got nothing to do with the autoimmune system and there weren't a defect in the red cell per se. You mentioned things like MAHAs and that kind of thing. What happens when we're dealing with those kind of hemolytic anemias?
Yeah. So I'll start with what's probably more common to the usual acute take patient cohort. So just check your patient for something like a mechanical heart valve. Tends to be more common that you would get hemolysis with a metallic heart valve, but sometimes you can also get it with a prosthetic also. And it's just caused because of high blood flow rate and shear through the valve, causing literal mechanical breakdown of the red cell. So that's the mechanical one. Then we've got more hematologically based ones like MAHAs. So MAHA stands for microangiopathic hemolytic anemia. The main one, there's a few. The main one is thrombotic thrombocytopenic purpura, or TTP. There's a pentad that's usually associated with it. So there is three clinical features and two more laboratory features. The laboratory features are thrombocytopenia and anemia, and then the clinical features are fever, neurological symptoms, and renal symptoms. On the blood film, you'd see a report saying something like there are schistocytes, which are basically red cell fragments caused by the, again, shear through the small vasculature in the body. If your patient has anything like this, you just want to be calling hematology pretty urgently, and we will try to sort of arrange things like a line and get them in for plasma exchange and things like that, and some more specialist medication. But yeah, that's definitely a discussion for hematology. Then there's paroxysmal nocturnal hemoglobinuria, which isn't very common, but tends to come up quite a lot in exams, unfortunately, but is basically caused by a mutation in a gene in one of the stem cell precursors, which makes the red blood cells so that they then lack a certain protein. If that protein was actually present, then it inhibits hemolysis by complement, but because they're not present on the red cell surface, complement will be activated and break those cells down. Then there's a few sort of clinical manifestations of PNH. It's not always as clear-cut as just having hemoglobinuria in the morning. It can present in a multitude of ways, so things like cytopenias, VTE, by which I mean PE, DVTs, and also abnormal sites of thrombosis. So for example, mesenteric or something intra-abdominal, you would be thinking about a PNH screen in that case. They also have sort of smooth muscle issues, so esophageal spasm, for example, or erectile dysfunction, which might be difficult to discuss with your patient, and things like pulmonary hypertension. And again, it's a discussion with hematology, and we will sort them out with a complement inhibiting medication called ravulizumab or eculizumab, which is a C5 inhibitor, or pegcetacoplan, which is a C3 inhibitor. There's loads of other drugs that can cause hemolysis also, and there's also mention of things like infection, which can precipitate hemolysis, which may not necessarily be immune mediated, and there also might be traumatic features also, for example foot strike hemolysis, which again very rarely reported and probably not something that you need to know for the MRCP, but maybe just to be aware. And then there's just the final thing I wanted to say was just about the main investigation after you've discussed with us. We'll tend to ask you to do a hemolysis screen. So that would include a full blood count, a film, a direct antiglobulin test, an LFT for the bilirubin, LDH, and a haptoglobin.
Wonderful. There were a couple of things about what you just mentioned that I just wanted to briefly ask. Mm. I know you mentioned TTP. In my head, I always pair that with hemolytic uremic syndrome. Is that something that is that even rarer? Is that the one that's associated with E. coli?
Yeah, yes. So there are, like I said before, there are lots and lots of different types of MAHAs. TTP is only one of them, but you're right. Hemolytic uremic syndrome is another one. And there's two types of hemolytic uremic syndrome. So there's HUS, the normal one, and then there's also atypical HUS. And regular HUS is caused by E. coli 0157 infection, yes. Well remembered.
Thank you. That's the only reason I brought it up, was because it's the one bit of this that seemed to stick in my head. Brilliant. And then obviously, as you mentioned, the hemolysis screen, which I guess is essentially one of the most relevant bits, because once you understand the varying forms of hemolysis, the hemolysis screen will make plenty of sense. So like you say, you want to see if there's a macrocytic anemia, you want to be able to see any of those signs on the blood film that you've mentioned. Obviously you're going to have an increase in your bilirubin if you've got a breakdown of the cells. And the haptoglobin you expect to be low, right? Because that should be mopping up the breakdown products.
Yep.
Just before we summarize, in terms of the direct antiglobulin test, you want to tell us a little bit about why that picks up autoimmune-mediated hemolysis?
Yeah, so the DAT is essentially using the patient's red blood cells. You wash them, you add a substance called antihuman globulin to them, and then you see if there's agglutination to various things. And one of them is a IgG and one of them is C3D, which looks at complement. So then you're sort of looking at whether it's an intact immunoglobulin versus a complement mediated problem.
Thank you very much for taking us through that. Obviously, we've covered a lot of varying forms of hemolysis. If you had a couple of key points for people from what we've talked about, what would you want them to take away?
So the main thing I would say is just to take a really good history. Is there a clear cause for their hemolysis? Is there something really obvious, like did their dad have hereditary spherocytosis also, and that's what they've also presented with? Or does the patient have an infection, or have they had some medication that could have precipitated all of this? So it's just taking a really thorough history and looking out for certain triggers. So I find that often infection and malignancy can pretty much cause a lot of the of what we've talked about. So just sort of really screening for that. And then just like I said before about the importance of the hemolysis screen, I think if you've already done that by the time you've discussed with your hematology colleagues, they'll be very impressed. And yes, contact your hematology colleagues for further advice if you're unsure. We're usually fairly friendly.
Always, always very friendly. Perfect. Thank you so much for talking us through everything.
It's okay.
What we might do is try and do another episode at some point in the future, maybe looking at a case, like applying some of the stuff we've talked about today. So everyone needs to keep their eyes peeled for that. Make sure to look back through the old episodes as well and keep an eye out for what's coming up next week on the Instagram and the Twitter X, whatever we're calling it now. So I guess all that remains is to say thank you again. Thank you again, Aritri, for coming on.
No worries. Thank you for having me.
Nice one. And thanks, everybody, for tuning in and listening. Thank you. Bye.